What a pleasure and what a privilege to be back at All Souls. I bring you greetings from Spokane, Washington, or as we call it, Berkeley North, and from the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist and its Dean, Bill Ellis. Bill was also a seminarian at All Souls, although before I was, he was a seminarian 30 years ago. And I am under strict instructions that if any of you know Bill from that time, you are to send me back with as many embarrassing stories as possible. Thanks so much for letting me share this Sunday with you. For six consecutive Sundays, concluding with this one, the lectionary has been walking us through the book known as 1 John. We have read the book almost in its entirety, with just the omission of a handful of verses. It's been special to have this much time with this book. 1 John is a challenging and exciting read, and it's a timely read. The more that I sit with this book, the more that I feel that it speaks with particular force to us today. Pretty much from the beginning, 1 John was categorized as a letter. That's how it's labeled in ancient documents, and that's how it is labeled in our Bible to this day. But as we look at it, we find that it lacks the characteristics that a letter had in the ancient world. Compare and contrast it with the letters of Paul, and you'll immediately notice the absence of Paul's ornate introductions. So, to the beloved of God in Rome, or Corinth, or Galatia, or Philippi, Paul, a servant of Christ, none of that is here. 1 John gets into the heavy-duty theology right away. Scholars figure, therefore, that 1 John is best understood not as a letter, but rather as an example of testamentary literature. Now, you'll notice in that title a close sibling to the term Old and New Testament. You'll notice a sibling to the terms we heard today. So testify and testimony showed up in the reading we heard today. And you'll notice the very same word that we use in our contemporary document, the last will and testament. That's not coincidental. Testamentary literature is an example of what's usually a speech given by a great leader at the end of his life. And I say his because I don't think there are any testamentary speeches preserved by women. There certainly were women prophets in Scripture, but I don't think we have a speech from one of them. In that speech, the leader testifies about philosophy, about theology, about where God is at work in the world, about what really matters, about what his followers are to do after he is gone. The testamentary speech has gravitas by virtue of coming at the end of the leader's life. So Jacob and Moses and Joshua give testamentary speeches, and Jesus gives a testamentary speech. We have been reading his testamentary speech known as the Farewell Discourse over the last number of weeks. Today we hear him praying for his disciples. And that is not a coincidence either. The folks who put the lectionary together have deliberately put these two examples of testamentary literature together so that they may converse with one another and we may engage with them. First John is most likely written by the same individual or the same community which wrote the Gospel of John, and it encounters a lot of the same themes. In First John, there are three key arguments, each flowing out of the other, each setting the foundation for the other. The first argument has to do with the nature of God, whom Jesus called Father. The second is about who Jesus is in relationship and response to the Father. And the third is about our calling as disciples in light of those first two points. Looking back over these 5 and now 6 weeks, the argument that most pops out of the text for me is that first one, the nature of God. Indeed, I think we could argue that all of 1 John is a variation on that theme. It is a variation on the theme that we heard 2 weeks ago, God is love. Now, there are few statements about the nature of God which are more famous or more celebrated than God is love. God is love is one of the questions which appears on the entrance exam for Christianity. God is love, true or false? If you circled T, you're in. There is theology which pushes our limits, which makes us squirm, which excites us, but God is love is generally not that theology. Indeed, if as a preacher I wanted to give a homily that was thoroughly safe, that was guaranteed to offend no one, that was so dull it wouldn't cut through wet bread, I would tell you that God is love 5 or 7 times, and then I would sit down. It sucks that centuries of bad preaching and bad greeting cards have rendered God is love into something platitudinous, into something banal or obvious. Because I'd like to suggest that what John is saying here is mind-blowing, that if we listen to it seriously, it absolutely shakes our understanding of who God is, of where God is at work in the world, of who we are in relationship to God. My son, Ami, whom many of you know, Ami is 7, almost 8 now, tends to surprise me with theological questions when I'm least expecting them. Ami usually waits till the end of the day when I'm good and tired. After bath time and story time, he'll throw one of these questions out like a ball into the middle of our conversation. The experience of hearing them is startling. It's like that moment in a thriller where some vital piece of evidence falls out of a closet or falls out of somebody's pocket, and everybody stares at it in the startled realization of where the treasure has been buried all this time. His questions aren't easy. About 2 weeks ago, I had just tucked him in. I just turned out the lights, and I thought I was going to escape out the door. And Ami said, "Dad, does God exist?" Now, hearing that question, I briefly panicked. And 2 very bad ideas came into my head at more or less the same time. I don't know if you have this experience, but this happens to me a lot. The first bad idea was I thought of telling Ami that there was actually a book with the same title as his question. There's a book called Does God Exist? It's by Hans Kung, and it's 839 pages long. And I thought of suggesting to Ami that we could read Does God Exist? right after we finished Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. My second idea was even worse. Can you guess what it was? That's just about it. I thought about answering by saying, of course. Thanks be to God, I acted on neither of those ideas. The synaptic guard who keeps most of the inappropriate comments from making their way from my mind to my mouth was on duty that day, and the Hans Kung suggestion got apprehended. And I was saved from saying, of course, by the memory of my old professor, Ian Slater. Dr. Slater argued that turns of phrase like of course, or obviously, or without a doubt, what else is in that pantheon? Certainly, absolutely. Phrases like that are the equivalent of shouting to make your point. They are a concession that your argument is weak. And they are particularly pathetic and particularly short-sighted when employed against a child. Because a child is not as practiced at argument as you or I. And of course will work for a few years. It might work until that child is 10 or 12 or even a little older than that. But a time will come when that young person realizes that, of course, is what Shakespeare's Macbeth called a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Thankfully, I had a third choice. Thankfully, Ami asked me this question at the same time that I was reading 1 John in connection with these 6 weeks. That sort of divine accident, that sort of happy synchronicity happens often enough to me, and I bet it happens to you as well, that it made me wonder about God's gentle sense of humor. It made me wonder about a God who really is love. And so I said to Ami, yes, God exists, but I don't think that God is a guy in a place. I don't think that if we searched long enough, we would find the cloud that God was on. That while there were ways in which God is like a person, that simile also breaks down after a while. God is something more than that, something harder to touch than that, something wilder than that. That while God is as close as ourselves, God is also somewhere else, somewhere we can't quite put our hands on. God is not so much a fistful of sand as the whole vast beach. And then I told Ami that John says that God is love. And maybe it takes the wonder of a 7-year-old to appreciate how awesome that statement really is. John has taken God and love and drawn an equal sign between them. Maybe we can only hear the theological audacity of that by rephrasing his formula, by switching it around, by saying love is God. What John testifies to us is that when we have loved another person, be it a parent or a child or a sibling or a friend or a lover, or, as Jesus provocatively suggests an enemy, we have known God. When we have loved creation, when we have seen beauty in a sunset or in a bird or in art, we have known God. And when we've done something we love, when we have said yes to vocation, when we have woken up and become fully alive, become the people that we are called to be, we have known God. John invites us to contemplate a God who is exciting and out of control and disconcerting. How would our lives look differently? Maybe I want to rephrase that. How do our lives look different when we take John seriously, when we believe that God is love? How did the great debates of the last 50 years change when they were guided by a God who is love? How does this challenge us as church? Because what John is telling us, this God who is exciting and out of control and disconcerting, well, God is especially these things, especially exciting, especially out of control, especially disconcerting for us as church. Church has been very good at an old school teaching model, at a model where we within these walls have something to teach and the people outside of the walls have something to learn. We kind of keep God inside these walls and we invite people to come in and learn about that God. We invite them to come in and be filled up with our knowledge and our piety. And the person who has the greatest knowledge and the greatest piety is me. Father knows best. God is love absolutely subverts that model. It invites us into a place of far more mutual teaching, far more transformative teaching than that. It insists that the people in our neighborhood, in our community, know God already because they love. It insists in the inspiring and provocative words of the priest and theologian Ellen Clark King that God's love is promiscuous. Isn't that awesome? It means that our job is not to fill people up with knowledge of God, but to invite them to engage more deeply, to respond more fully, to enter further into conversation with the God whom they already know. What an exciting time to be church. I'd like to leave you with Ami's question and with not an answer, but a guess at how to encounter it as inspired by 1 John. Does God exist? Picture someone whom you love. That might be someone alive today. It might be someone who is gone. It might be someone who died years ago. Picture sitting with that person, telling stories with that person, laughing and crying with that person. Picture just being with that person. Does God exist? This is John's testament for us. God is love. May we live accordingly.